another hot one for the 4th of July. Wednesday's high 89, the heat index near 98. This morning, though, nice. 68 in Kenosha, 67 Racine, humidity down to 73%. Wind from the northwest at 6. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, I am delighted to be sitting opposite two gentlemen I know very, very well because of our mutual involvement in the Kenosha Pops Band each and every summer. Craig Gall, the music director of the Kenosha Pops Band, in his 16th year as music director of the organization, is with us in the studios, and he has brought with him Frank Germanaro, whose history with the Kenosha Pops Band dates back a lot farther than that, not quite to the days of Beethoven, but nearly so. And so Frank Germanaro has become Craig Gall's assistant in an interesting reversal of history, since Craig began as assistant director under Frank Germanaro some years ago. So, but it is the two of them leading the band with such distinction, and a very busy and exciting 4th of July concert is coming up this Wednesday night down at Wolfenbüttel Park. We're going to talk about that and just kind of about the season in general, again, for part one of today's morning show. Craig Gall, Frank Germanaro, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Hi.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Good to have you here. So, Frank, let's get this straight. It's not back to Beethoven, but back to the 1960s. Explain to our listeners your very first involvement with the Kenosha Pops Band.
They needed a sub on drums, and I never hit a drum before, but I was a music major at Parkside. And it was the summer of 66, and I would step in there a couple times and drum. And the same thing happened in 67, but by now I was playing a little clarinet, so I would step into the clarinet section, and they would either give me the E-flat alto or the bass, which was way too big, and or third-part clarinet. I always tease, third-part clarinet right next to the French horns.
There you go.
Yeah. And in 68, I was made an official member, and 10 years before John Bunick retired, I was made his assistant. So this is my second stint as assistant.
Right.
And then in, I don't know, we were talking about the date, 95? Was it 95, Craig? I can't remember. When I became the director.
That sounds right.
Yeah,
95. Officially. You served a couple of seasons kind of as an interim.
Interim, that's right. They were looking for a conductor.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So, Frank, when you first became assistant conductor to John Bunick, what kind of experience had you had at that point as a conductor?
None. I had my own band. I was very successful as a wedding and party band. I played a lot of music. It's not that I didn't know music. But as far as conducting in front of a band, that was the first time.
Waving a baton.
We'd come into rehearsal, and John Bunick would tell me, "You're doing these four." Oh, okay.
And make the best.
Yeah, surprise. I suppose I learned on the job.
Ah.
I learned on the job. That's how they went. And I loved it. And I applied myself.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you're still here, so it loves you too.
Yeah.
Craig Gaw, your road to the podium is a little more conventional. You really went to school to study all of this, of course, and have been a very successful and happy band conductor for many, many years, right?
That's right. I started my teaching career after graduating from Lawrence University back in 1990 at Washington Junior High, when Washington was still a junior high. And I was the band director there for 6 years before moving up to Kimberly High School, where I have been the past 23 now. And it was in 1992 when Mr. Bunick approached me to play euphonium with the Kenosha Pops, and which I happily did from the seasons of 92 until 95. And then it was, I think, at the end of the 95 season that right. that Frank approached me to be his assistant conductor.
Right.
And then, as fate would have it, the following summer when I was supposed to start, I told Frank, I said, "Hey, I'm going through a job change here." I said, I don't know how I can fulfill these duties. And Frank convincingly said, "Well, my kids are out of the house now. You can live in the basement during the summer. My wife will cook you lunch." And that's how this all started. And that went on for 7 years. 7 years of shacking up in your basement.
I know. I know. You should see the basement.
Right.
Oh, it's fixed up quite nice.
Yes, it is. Yes. Thank you.
But that's how this all started. And then when Frank stepped down, the board came to me and said, "Would you consider taking over the reins?" And I said yes. Mm-hmm. And that was 16 years ago.
Right. So for a gig that you saw at the outset, at least, as being a fairly short-term sort of fun little lark, has become something else.
Well, it certainly has. And often people ask me, "Why do you do all this running around in summers?" I live in Appleton, and it's just because the people in the band are so neat and fun to work with.
Yeah.
The band plays at such a high level that it makes the trip worthwhile, and it's just so gosh darn much fun. We have so much fun in rehearsals, on the stage. For the past 15 years, I shared the podium with Garrett Kornman, who was a gentleman that I met my first year of teaching here in Kenosha. And when I took over as conductor, he was the first person I had in mind to be my assistant. And that was a great partnership for 15 years. I probably should mention Garrett has moved on. After spending his entire life here in Kenosha working in the banking realm as a commercial lender, he has accepted a job up in the Wausau area, and he unloaded that news in my lap right after the holidays. And so right away, the wheels started turning, and I had to start thinking about who am I going to ask to replace Garrett. And I thought, well, Frank's fresh off of a very successful kidney surgery.
Kidney, what better way to celebrate? Yeah.
And I said, I've worked with the guy before. I know we work together well. Why not ask Frank to see what his thoughts were, to if he would even entertain the idea of doing this all over again? And foolishly, he said yes.
Well, it's fun again. That's why. We're warning you. Yeah. This foolishness will be starting next
That's
year.
That's right. Yeah, no kidding. Right.
Yeah, we're all set. Yeah.
So we're speaking with Craig Gaul and Frank Germanaro, who are the director and assistant director, respectively, of the Kenosha Pops Band, the band's summer season of Wednesday night concerts in Panoia Park at the Band Shell is already underway with, is it two concerts we've already had?
Oh, we're four. Up to three. Our fifth concert this week. Yeah,
this week will be five.
Oh, my gosh.
Four in the history books already.
Time flies. Wow. So Wednesday night's 4th of July concert is not in Panoia Park, but rather down in Wolfenbüttel Park, really close to where the fireworks are shot off. We'll talk about those that concert in just a moment. Craig, you were talking about how one of the reasons you've elected to do this for such a long time, to hang in here for all these years despite the long commute, is mostly the people. I mean, the people who are in the band.
Right.
Give our listeners some sense of who these people are. I mean, generally speaking, where do they come from? What kind of expertise do they bring? How do they become a part of the band? I mean, who populates the band and what sort of determines who is on that stage?
Well, first of all, they're all saints for having to put up with Frank and myself. But they're from all walks of life. Quite a few of the band members are school band directors, high school, middle school band directors from
elementary.
Elementary too, yeah. Right, from the Kenosha and the Racine areas. So that kind of forms the nucleus, I would say, of the group. But we have people that are as old as 80 years old. Our tenor saxophone player has been with the band for, what, over 60 years?
Yeah, I think it was 54, 55.
So, okay, yeah.
Marv joined, yeah.
And we have kids as young as just out of high school. The stipulation is that, obviously, you have mastered your instrument well enough to be able to sit down and sight-read music. So our band contractor every year goes around to the local high school band directors and asks, who are some of your top-notch graduates that might be interested in playing with us? So we tap into that younger talent, and every walk of life. I'm not sure what all of our people do.
We have an assistant DA,
right?
We
our band manager is the assistant DA.
Yeah, we have a radio personality.
That's true. That's true. Yes.
All kinds of riffraff up on that stage. Yeah.
That's how we like it.
I suppose part of the things that we should make clear to people is one of the reasons you really need top-notch musicians, and especially musicians who can just look at a piece of music and make sense of it right on the off, is because of the tight gauntlet of rehearsal time. I mean, explain how quickly these concerts get put together.
Well, these 90-minute concerts that we perform on Wednesday nights are put together in a two-hour rehearsal the Monday evening before at UW Parkside, where we rehearse. Frank and I have gone through months prior to this. We pick our concert themes and the music that'll go on each of the concerts, and we get this list of music to our band librarian so she can have the folders loaded for the first rehearsals in June. We have two rehearsals in June that are just strictly rehearsals. We can go over some of the newer music or some of the things we haven't played in many years, just so we can acclimate the band members to some of this new stuff and kind of give them a heads up, you know, if you need to take any of this home, you'll know which ones you'll need to work on. But then once the season starts, we rehearse Monday nights for 90 minutes, for 2 hours for what essentially will become a 90-minute concert. We don't do a lot of woodshedding. We don't do a lot of intense rehearsing. If some things go haywire when we're reading through stuff, we'll go over and make corrections, and then immediately we'll move on. So that's why when we're pulling All right. kids from the from just out of high school, that we need to know that they're going to be able to sit down and do the work without a lot. It's not like in high school where we've got a couple of months to prepare a concert.
Right, and day after day after day, you're rehearsing something.
Right. This is, you sit down and you see a piece of music for 3-4 minutes, and that's going to be it before it's being played on the concert in 2 days.
Right, yeah. That's just the inescapable math of it.
Precisely.
That, there's barely any time to even play through something twice in a rehearsal like that.
That's rare. Rarely happens.
It's rare.
Right. Mm-hmm. Craig, say a word about the themes that typically kind of carry the day in terms of various concerts for the Kenosha Pops Band.
Well, we try to do a theme every week. We don't lock ourselves into themes. Sometimes the first concert of the summer is a themeless concert and just kind of a welcome back concert. But we like doing themes because it makes programming much more interesting, I think. Last week we did a very unique theme that we had last done back in 2009 called Of Captains and Kings. So essentially, if the piece was written by or about anyone of royalty or military ranking, it was fair game on the program. So we played music by Duke Ellington and Count Basie, and we played marches like El Capitan and a Sousa march called King Cotton. We did highlights from the Sgt. Pepper album, and it just made for such a great variety of music. We had Broadway music on that concert with The King and I. But other concerts that we're doing this summer coming up next week, well, we'll talk about Garrett's return next week. But in 2 weeks, we're doing a French-themed concert. The week after that, we're doing Latin music. That is a theme that always comes back every 3 or 4 years. It's the band loves playing this music, and I think the audience holds great affection for this style of music. It gets your feet tapping. August 1st is a nautical theme, a nautical night theme, anything related to the high seas. And then our last concert of the summer is always an encore concert of things the band members like to play or things that we've heard from the audience. Oh, yeah. That was great. Could you play that again? So that final concert of the summer, which this summer is August 8th, will be our encore concert. So we do all kinds of different thematic things, and it just makes it fun and exciting.
It does make it fun, yes. And it's been a format that was started a while ago.
Right, and it certainly works. Yeah. Say a word about Pennoyer Park. Again, Wednesday night we're down in Wolfenbüttel Park, but normally we're playing on the bandshell at Pennoyer Park. What's your opinion of that Pennoyer Park bandshell?
It's a beautiful location to see and hear a concert. Parking is fairly decent for our concert patrons. It's a beautiful location. There's kind of a berm that the audience sits on, and it kind of gives great views of the stage. You're never really, nobody's really ever sitting in front of you. So it's a beautiful view, beautiful venue, and as long as Mother Nature is behaving herself. Just an ideal setting for
which
concerts.
She really has this summer thus
far. This summer we've been lucky.
Usually the Weather Monkeys has been on our back, and but this summer we're doing well.
Yeah,
they also provide benches, so you can bring a blanket.
Yeah,
or sit on the benches.
Benches are provided. Yeah. Oh, and we also have Sandy's Popper from downtown Kenosha provides concessions, popcorn and soda and other types of treats. So. Because if the music doesn't keep you happy, the concession should.
Absolutely. So let's talk about Wednesday night's concert then. It's not all that often, of course, that the 4th of July falls right on the Wednesday night. So here it is. The band always plays on the 4th of July no matter what, and then typically we'll kind of encore that patriotic lineup on the closest Wednesday night. But it all happens Wednesday night, the 4th. Down in Wolfenbüttel Park. So, Craig, give us, our listeners, some idea of what's going to be played on Wednesday night.
Strictly patriotic fare. We're doing a couple of arrangements of American folk tunes by one of our favorite band arrangers, Claire Grundman. We're doing several marches, of course, things like Semper Fidelis and Washington Post, and kind of a hometown favorite, the 32nd Division March, which was written by William Steinmetz, which was written for the famous fighting 32nd Division during World War I, actually, which was comprised of Wisconsin soldiers and Michigan soldiers, I believe. So things of this nature. Frank's going to be conducting a medley of Irving Berlin, patriotic favorites. The Continental Recreation Band, under the direction of Brittany Sabetic, one of the summer recreation bands here in the city of Kenosha, will be joining us before the concert. They'll be starting around 6:15 and playing some selections, and they'll also be joining us on the concert to end the first half of the concert with a very nice arrangement of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which you, of course, will be lending your voice to.
Me.
You. Yes.
You.
And then the second half of the concert kind of prepares everybody for the fireworks.
Right.
We really get heavy with the patriotic stuff at that point, and kind of the trademark of that portion of the concert is about a 20-minute medley of the full-length versions of all of the service marches.
Five of them.
Five service marches played with street beat material in between, and then we end with the national anthem and finally close the concert with the Stars and Stripes Forever.
Right. And, of course, we have people from those various divisions standing in the audience as their march is played. It's always really stirring. So the concert begins at 7 o'clock, 4th of July, down at Wolfenbüttel Park, which is right there by where the fireworks are shot off. And before we're out of time, we do want to say something about the following concert a week from Wednesday, which is going to be something of a farewell concert for your longtime collaborator, Garrett Kornman.
It will be. We're going to miss Garrett a lot. Garrett is coming back for his farewell concert next week. His schedule permitted him coming down, which is a good thing because both Frank and I are gone next week, so we won't even be around for Garrett's farewell. But I'm going to be in Austria, and Frank is up north fishing. But Garrett is going to be coming back to conduct a no-themed concert, just things he's enjoyed either playing or conducting over the past 15 years.
Oh, what a nice idea.
And
nice?
So he sent me a list of his favorites back before the season started, and we got all those things into the folder, and it'll be a very nice send-off for Garrett, I'm sure.
Excellent.
I'll entrust you to make sure he feels missed.
Absolutely.
Next week.
Well, we already miss him. But in the meantime, so then Wednesday night we're down at Wolfenbüttel Park, and then a week from Wednesday back in Pennoyer Park with Garrett Kornman's farewell concert and other fun to follow until the finale, the final concert of the summer, which again is when?
August 8th.
August 8th, because of the fourth landing on a Wednesday, we're extending the season 1 week into August this
Very
year.
Good.
So more pops.
More
Absolutely.
Pops for you.
And we hope Mother Nature continues to be kind to the band. So we're all continue to say our prayers.
Indeed.
So Craig Gall and Frank Germanaro, the director and assistant director of the Kenosha Pops Band. Gentlemen, what a pleasure to have you here. And I thank you for getting up bright and early on this Monday morning to be part of the morning show and to tell our listeners a little bit about the Kenosha Pops Band. A group that means a whole lot to all of us. And
thank you for giving us an opportunity to talk about these great people.
Yes.
You bet. Glad to have you here. 8:31. Part two is an excerpt from my conversation with L. John Wertheim, a Sports Illustrated writer. With Wimbledon getting underway, I wanted to play an excerpt from the interview we did about his book, Strokes of Genius, Federer, Nadal, and the Greatest Match Ever Played. This looks back at an amazing final a few years back in which Rafael Nadal edged Roger Federer in five sets, an amazing match. In fact, a documentary film about that memorable match has just been released. And here is a portion of our conversation. One of the things I think your book does such a good job of doing is to characterize the contrast between Mr. Federer and Mr. Nadal without falling back on some of the cliches or caricatures, which are so tempting, even for sports journalists. I mean, we find all kinds of interesting comparisons made. I mean, one of your colleagues at Sports Illustrated, S.L. Price, likened Federer to Fred Astaire and Rafael Nadal to Marlon Brando, and someone else wrote something about, you know, beauty versus brawn or brain versus brawn. One of the things your book does is to in a sense, caution us to not reach for that, because there is plenty of brawn and guts in Roger Federer, and there is plenty of artistry in Rafael Nadal.
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime there are rivalries, it's sort of very easy to, you know, do what they do in movies, or sort of do what we see in other senses, and just make it to sort of this dualism, and you've got a good guy and a bad guy, and it sort of just break things down into opposites and compare and contrast, and it's more nuanced with these two guys, and it sort of shortchanges them to just sort of make it out as something as simple as, you know, art versus science, or brain versus brawn, or good versus evil. I mean, I think something that makes this rivalry so unique is first of all the complexity. That Federer, I think, is a lot grittier, and we saw this first round match at Wimbledon, but a lot grittier than he's sort of given credit for. And Nadal is a lot more sort of artistic than he's given credit for. And it just I sort of understand the temptation, and we like to have sort of easy points of comparison, but it's just a much more complex dynamic than, you know, an A side versus a B side, you know, an A versus a B like that.
We're speaking with L. John Wertheim about his book Strokes of Genius, which examines Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, and in particular the amazing final which they played at Wimbledon in 2008. Something which I missed the first time I read your book and just caught when I took up your book again to prepare for this interview, is something you mentioned in the acknowledgments, that you looked back to a book that was written many years ago by someone named John McPhee. And it's a book I've never read, but I really want to try to get my hands on a copy of this. And you mentioned the book in the acknowledgments to, in effect, contrast what this author did with a certain great match from many years ago and what you did with this particular match. Can you just tell our listeners about that interesting contrast?
Yeah, the John McPhee, sort of a great prolific writer who's writes a lot for The New Yorker, probably in his 70s now. He wrote a book, it must be almost 40 years ago, titled Levels of the Game. And he took a match between Arthur Ashe and a player, Graebner, another American, and sort of used this U.S. Open match to talk about a number of topics. And I thought that just worked so well, and I thought that was also a pretty effective device to discuss Nadal and Federer. And sort of, people like a great tennis match, but nobody wants to read, 200 pages about forehands and aces up the middle and play-by-play. And John McPhee was sort of able to use the give and take of tennis and, the ball going over from one side of the net to the other. It really sort of lends itself pretty well to this sort of exploration. And then that was, definitely an inspiration. I mean, it was a little different in a variety of senses. Number one, a lot of the theme with the Arthur Ashe book was race relations and the state of the U.S. at the time, late 60s, early 70s. And that obviously, wasn't so relevant to Federer and Nadal. But just the notion of framing a broader discussion within the context of a single match, I thought was really effective.
Of course, what he did is he sat down with tape of the film back then of that match and these two players. And, of course, you didn't get to do that with Mr. Federer and Mr. Nadal. In effect, your book is the result of not an afternoon with these two players, but sort of your ongoing relationship with both of them and many others who know them well.
Yeah, I think it says something. And I hope, Federer and Nadal couldn't be sort of nicer and more accessible. And, they're both sort of supported and helped with this project. I think it's just a sign of the times and a symptom of the demands that are put on celebrity. But when John McPhee wrote this book, he sort of caught up with Arthur Ashe and he had a tape of the match and they sat in a hotel room for 4 hours and sort of watched it stroke by stroke. And, it was great. It would be great to have that sort of access and that sort of availability. But it's hard to imagine too many contemporary athletes with that sort of time on their hands. So, yeah, I had to go about it a little bit differently. But, but Federer and Nadal both, and I think that's part of the overall story, too, is that for everything we see about celebrity and for all the trouble certain athletes have gotten into, you couldn't, apart from the athleticism and sort of how they play out as sportsmen, you couldn't ask for lack of a better phrase, two better guys. I mean, just two good guys that people should feel good about rooting for. People should feel good about having them represent tennis. And, cynically, some of us sort of wait for the other shoe to drop and hope there's not a Tiger Woods or a Kobe Bryant moment. But I don't think that's going to happen. And part of what makes this rivalry so special is these guys have been able to do what they do at this level and still basically be good human beings.
So, right.
It's all sort of all the more reason to root for them.
Here's the way you write it at one point in your book. I think you say this so well. Perhaps because neither player is remotely offensive, Federer and Nadal do not cleave public opinion the way most rivals do. And I hadn't stopped to think about that, but that really is true, that once upon a time, chances are you liked Billie Jean King or Margaret Court, or you liked Chris Evert, or you liked Martina Navratilova. And there might be a few fans that honestly, authentically liked them both, but chances are you would really be choosing Borg or McEnroe and not rooting for them both. But you suggest that this is a different kind of rivalry where you have lots of people that want both of these players to win.
Yeah, I mean, you think about all sports rivalries, and whether it's tennis, Borg-McEnroe, or whether it's Ali Frazier or Lakers-Celtics, or I'm just sort of Oregon State, and I mean whatever the rivalry is, there usually is this element of dislike and disdain, and nobody says they like, you know, Rush Limbaugh and Keith Olbermann. In this rivalry, it's just funny though, because it seems like it's totally normal to root for either of them and both of them, and I think a lot of that is a function of the fact that they don't dislike each other at all. So if Federer has nothing but nice things to say about Nadal and vice versa, and they just asked Nadal if he might be better than Federer, and he said anyone that suggests that doesn't know tennis. So imagine saying to Muhammad Ali, do you think Frazier is better than you? And he says, of course, if you don't think Frazier is better than I am, you don't know boxing. So, I mean, I think this sort of gentlemanly give and take between Federer and Nadal trickles down to their fans, and it's funny to have a rivalry where you feel totally normal rooting for both, and both guys like each other. But it's sort of another quirk. It's sort of another quirk, because I think their relationship with each other trickles down to how fans feel about them both.
Absolutely. And I think a very impressive fact also, which your book recounts for us, is that there is also great respect when it comes to their respective entourages. I mean, the two families feel good about each other, and even those who work with each of these players have tremendous respect and even affection for the others. I was especially impressed by some of what Tony Nadal, this would be Rafael's uncle and his coach, some of what he has to say about Roger Federer. I mean, it's kind of astonishing, the praise that he heaps on Roger Federer.
Yeah, it's funny too, that Wimbledon match, at the final, the way the players' box is set up, one player's entourage sits behind the other. So, I always say when my son plays, 8 years old, when he plays Little League, one team stands on one side of the field and the other team's parents stand on the other. Here in the Wimbledon final, the pinnacle of this sport, the two families sit one row behind each other. So it's sort of, you learn to like the opposition. But I think, I think both families sort of have this sporting tradition. They understand, you can be competitive. You can have an adversary without necessarily having, dislike. And I think they're all sports fans, so they sort of stand back. And I think the Federers realize and recognize what Nadal has achieved and vice versa. And, imagine, put this in any other context. Imagine, the uncle of LeBron James saying, oh, no question, Kobe Bryant's the superior player. Or, imagine the entourage of Kentucky basketball saying, oh, I think Louisville actually has a superior team. So it's really sort of jarring to see such an intense rivalry and then have this sort of respect for the other person that really sort of bleeds over almost into admiration.
Especially because, as you tell us at some point, tennis is a real gladiatorial sport in many respects, and yet a sport which, especially at a place like Wimbledon, tends to call for a certain kind of collegiality, which we often don't see at all in other kinds of sports.
Yeah, and I think because there's a net dividing the players, people sometimes misconstrue just how brutal this is. But, it's you and your opponent, and there's no coaching, there's no sort of, there's no entourage between rounds to give you water and pump up your confidence, and there's no teammates, obviously. It's just sort of you and the other dude, and one of you is going to walk off the winner and one of you is going to walk off the loser, and there's really no alternative. So, I think because of the tradition and because, two guys with rackets and a net dividing them, hitting a ball on a lawn, doesn't necessarily come to mind two guys fighting, it doesn't get enough credit. But it's really a pretty brutal individual sport.
Let's talk about each of these players and just a few of the observations which you make about them. I think you make a very interesting observation. I think actually you might be quoting someone else in saying that Roger Federer, who is Swiss, plays tennis that is quintessentially Swiss. That was somebody else's observation, but do you care to explain how Roger Federer is, as a player, quintessentially Swiss?
To lapse into stereotype, but you sort of think about Swiss characteristics, and there's a sort of precision and this punctuality. You think of the Swiss watch and all the gears going in order and the real, I mean, I guess precision is the word I always come back to. You think about sort of a certain neutrality, a certain diplomacy, all the characteristics that, you know, the guy on the street would associate with Switzerland sure applies awfully well to Federer's personality and his tennis.
I was really struck by this observation. You said, to his parents' frustration, Federer was an indifferent, restless student in school, not dim, but not particularly dedicated. Tennis, however, fed something in him and commanded his full attention. I think that is the way it plays out with a whole lot of people, that you achieve greatness in the thing that you most love to do. But I especially love that idea about tennis for Roger Federer being something that commanded his full attention. In the end, that's probably what all of us need to find, is that thing that draws us to it in the way that tennis drew Roger Federer.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other interesting thing is that for all the, you know, the quote-unquote tennis parents, for all these sort of hardcore sports parents that are arranging for extra batting practice and hiring nutritionists and pushing their kids, the Federers were the opposite. I mean, this is sort of a well-educated, middle-class family, and, you know, they wanted him to be a better student, and if he's happened to like tennis, well, fine, you can ride your bike to the club after school, but, you know, we ain't pulling you out of class so you can hit a ball across the net. And it ended up that sort of, in a weird way, that hands-off approach probably motivated him more than anything. And, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of his friends sort of joked, if this had been 10 years later, he would have had a, you know, ADHD diagnosis, that he was, you know, not a dumb guy by any stretch, but just one of those kids in school that's restless, had a hard time sitting still. And the tennis court, he could get out there and obviously had some of the hand-eye coordination and some of the natural talent, but also just sort of being there and running around. And he was part of a tennis team, but there weren't, you know, they're obviously not teammates, so you sort of have collegiality and the camaraderie without depending on someone to pass you the ball or play defense. And tennis, you know, tennis just sort of clicked for him. And you hear him talk about his love of the game, and it's clear, as you said, this was sort of he feels like he's found the one thing in life he was cut out to do. And obviously, you know, we should all be so lucky.
Yeah, I like how you said at one point that his parents were not pushy. If anything, they were pulley. If they nudged him at all, it was to stop taking tennis so seriously. But, of course, tennis itself seemed to have another idea. A couple other observations about Roger Federer, which I really appreciated as I reread your book. One thing you said is that the first title, major title, which Roger Federer won, his first title at Wimbledon, and was that back in 2003, I think? You said that, in a sense, this first title had a catalytic effect, as if a spigot had been tapped. Tell us what happened once Roger Federer had won this first major title at Wimbledon. What did that seem to do for him?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because people seem to forget now that there were about, you know, it sort of reminds me of Michael Jordan in the beginning and certainly LeBron James now, where there were a few years there, not obviously LeBron James in 7 years, but there were a few years when it was sort of like, okay, this Federer guy's talented and everybody's talking about what he does on the practice court, but, you know, time to put up or shut up. But there'd been a lot of disappointing results, and he was just sort of been known as the guy who had a lot of talent and was he ever going to do anything with it. And then he had a terrible loss in the first round of the French Open that year in 2003, and people were really giving up on him and saying this guy's just a talented head case. And then 4 weeks later he goes and wins Wimbledon, and it was just sort of, you know, some players reach the top, especially in tennis, and they just sort of say, great, I've achieved it, and now everything else is gravy, and they have a hard time sustaining it. And he sort of had the opposite reaction, which is, I've got to the top of the mountain, now I know what I have to do to get here, and, you know, I'm going to stay here for a while. So once he, you know, this was his first Grand Slam final in 2003, he wins that match, and then it was just lights out. I mean, then that started this era we're in now that, you know, 7 years later is made him the best player ever.
It's just interesting to think about how that worked for him, because one also thinks about certain players who win one major singles title and then, for whatever reason, don't quite manage to follow it up. I mean, a Michael Chang with one and only one French Open title, or Andy Roddick, or let's see, has he won more than one U.S. Open title?
One U.S. Open.
Yeah. Exactly. So it is. It doesn't always work this way, but it sure worked for Roger Federer.
Right. I mean, the other thing too that we see is players sort of yo-yo up and down. I mean, Andre Agassi was, obviously sort of the prime example of that. But other players too, they're up, they're down. You know, the Williams sisters, they have some injuries. I mean, Serena at one point, was way outside the top 50. You know, Roger Federer has been either number one or number two for 6.5-7 years now. So apart from winning consistently, he also stayed up there in the rankings and didn't have one of these sort of dips and yo-yo careers that we also see a lot of.
You tell us that as Federer achieved greatness, one of the things that is most striking about him is that his entourage is, in your words, strikingly bare. I mean, he certainly has the means to be thickly insulated by an entourage that would sort of keep the world away. In fact, Federer does not operate that way.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, yet another reason to like the guy, that he sort of said, look, I'm at the top with just a few people around me, and it'll stay that way. He finally got an agent. He kind of sort of has a coach. His wife travels with him, but she also does administrative work, and, that's really about it. There are a lot of players who aren't ranked nearly as high who have a lot more people around him, and I think, I think it says a lot about who he is and what motivates him, but I also think that there's a real element of sort of self-sufficiency. I mean, he likes finding out solutions for himself. He likes sort of figuring out everything from, tactics to stringing. I think he doesn't want to be reliant on anyone else. And, again, it's another reason, as far as I'm concerned, it's another reason to be fond of the guy. That, as you say, you're right. I mean, here's a guy who makes tens of millions of dollars. He could have the personal, chef and, the personal masseuse and the whole team traveling with him as other players do, and he just sort of wants to keep it simple. And I think his attitude too, and I think this goes for a lot of things with him, is just why mess with success? This arrangement's done well for me. This racket's done well for me. Why do I need to tinker just because I might have the money or the opportunity to do so?
Rafael Nadal, you say, is often described as freakish, his genius in tennis described as freakish and fluky in a raised by wolves kind of way. And the fact that when one thinks about Rafael Nadal, very seldom do you say, oh, he reminds me of player X. I mean, he is very much a sort of a one-of-a-kind player. And yet you tell us Nadal's game is the opposite of alien. It's homemade and meticulously handcrafted. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, I mean, again, we sort of think about the tennis player, and you think about driven parents, and at a young age, the kid goes off to some academy and drops out of school and hits walls for 1,000 hours. And with Nadal and Federer both, they just came to this point by such an unusual way. And Federer's case, he just had this sort of middle-class upbringing in Switzerland. And in Nadal's case, he comes from this small Spanish island, he comes from Mallorca. There really hadn't been a big tennis history there. He has an uncle who certainly knows tennis but wasn't a pro or anything like that. Convert him from a righty to a lefty, which turned out to be a genius, and then sort of taught him these strokes. I mean, nobody hits the ball like Nadal has, and nobody is right now nobody's emulating him. It's a very unique way he plays tennis, and it's one of these things where you could scratch your head, you could say, hey, you've got a kid this talented, you should put him in an academy, but the family sort of did it their own way. And again, you can't really argue with the results, but both Federer and Nadal cut a very different figure from what we're used to in tennis. I mean, there's sort of and the Williams sisters too, for that matter. So if the top four players all came to their success so differently than sort of the conventional way, maybe the lesson from this is the conventional way needs to be reconsidered.
I especially appreciated the rules that were laid down by Rafael Nadal's uncle Tony, three in particular. And in some respects, the first says so much about this family. Uncle Tony's first rule for his nephew. If you ever throw a racket, we're finished. They're expensive, and when you throw a racket, you don't just disrespect the sport. You disrespect all the people who cannot afford equipment. That is a rule that should probably be stenciled in a lot of places where tennis is taught.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that says a lot, not just in terms of the decorum, but just sort of in terms of the whole philosophy. I mean, Nadal's uncle, who really, in some ways, is sort of a surrogate parent. I mean, this is the guy who coached him and traveled the world with him, and I guess a close-knit family. And I think the uncle basically, you know, he has this sort of my way or the highway mentality. And the uncle sort of, again, they don't come from traditional tennis stock. This is not a family that's sort of grown up. I mean, they're well off, but they didn't grow up with a lot of the, you know, material conveniences and status. And I think the uncle is very important to him, that no matter where his kid's career got, that he kept his values. And, you know, I've seen the guy in action, too. He means business. I mean, there are times where Nadal will forget his water bottle in the locker room, and they'll go out to the practice courts, and someone will fetch it for him, and the uncle will wave the court attendant off and said, no, you know, this was Rafael's responsibility, and he blew it. He's going to go in and get it. So you see the number one player in the world running across the tennis complex to get a water bottle because his uncle doesn't want him to feel like he can depend on others to cover up his errors.
Another decision his uncle made, you tell us that he did not want tennis to come too easily to Rafael, and so he would, for instance, make his nephew practice with dead balls and on pocked courts that gave dishonest bounces. In other words, he saw value in placing before his nephew obstacles that might create momentary frustrations, but which he obviously thought would further stiffen his spine and force him to achieve even greater skill.
Yeah, I mean, the uncle had a philosophy which I think is very smart, which is, look, on the days when everything's clicking and you're feeling great and you got a good night's sleep and the conditions are perfect, you know, anyone can go out there and play good tennis. It's the winners and losers are being determined by who can play their best tennis when everything's not going well, when there's some obstacles and some adversity you've got to figure out a way to surmount. So, you know, Nadal would have a great practice and the uncle would shrug and say, hey, it was a beautiful day and you got a good night's sleep. I expect you to be good. But what are you going to do now when I play you with these dead balls and I'm aiming for the cracks in the court, so they're going to take some funny hops? And I think that's certainly expresses itself in the way Nadal plays today.
Hmm. Most of your book, of course, is dedicated to this incredible match, blow by blow, set by set. You take us through this drama. And one of the things I think you achieve that's truly amazing is that anybody who follows tennis knows how this match is going to end. And yet somehow you've created an account of this match which reads like a thriller, or I mean like a suspense novel, even though obviously there can't be too much in the way of real suspense in terms of how this is going to turn out. Was that something you consciously tried to do?
No, I appreciate that. I mean, the match sort of packed it for itself, and just the turns and the twists that this match took were so naturally suspenseful. But no, you're right. I mean, it's like I said earlier, that nobody wants to hear in the third game Nadal hit a backhand down the line and Federer responded with a forehand. I mean, it had to be more than just sort of play-by-play. First of all, because you're right, everybody sort of knew the outcome already, but also just, probably doesn't make for interesting reading. So I think, the match itself really unfolded like a thriller. And, you know, as trite as it sounds, I do have a new respect for the phrase, a shame someone had to lose. Because, again, a lot of cliches there, but they both played well enough to win.
L. John Wertheim. And he is the author of this really interesting book called Strokes of Genius, Federer, Nadal, and the Greatest Match Ever Played. And there is a marvelous documentary film that just premiered last night on the Tennis Channel called Strokes of Genius, based in large measure on this really fascinating book. Well, tomorrow on the morning show, I am excited to talk about a very different sport, soccer. Of course, the World Cup competition is underway right now. And on tomorrow's morning show, soccer enthusiast and faculty colleague John Bruning from Carthage will be talking about what has already